This is Fabian Hiscock of Three Rivers Museum Trust. I'm interviewing Mick Hamilton at his home in Crotchley Green on the 4th of August 2026 for the Three Rivers Voices project, capturing what it's been like to live and work in Three Rivers over the last 50 years. Mick, how did you come to be in Three Rivers in the first place?
Well, we were living locally. We lived in Watford, and I have a civil engineering background, and I had done I'd done 2 or 3 years with a contractor, Robert McAlpine and Sons, and I needed to get some design experience so that I could become a chartered engineer. And at the time, there wasn't much design work going on in consultants, so I saw an advert for what was Rickmansworth Urban District Council wanting an engineer and a graduate engineer. So I went along for the interview and was interviewed by, I think his name was John Brown, the original engineer and surveyor, I think was his proper title, and chap John Parr, who was the chief engineer. It was a normal sort of interview until towards the end. I remember John Brown saying, "You're not married, are you?" And I said, "Well, yes, I was, but I didn't see how this would have any bearing on whether or not I got the job or not." And he said, "Oh, well, if you're married, we'll have to offer you accommodation if you're successful." Oh, so he got onto the housing department straight away in the middle of the interview, and they had a bit of an argument, and in the end he said, "Oh, well, if you're successful, then we'll offer you a 3-bed semi-detached house, number 2 Dugdales, and it will be £6 a week in rent or something." Well, at that time we were paying 9 guineas a week for a tiny little flat in Watford. So suddenly this job, which not only had the potential for design experience, also came with a massive house to us.
Which year was that?
72. Now Dugdales, you know where it is at the end of Baldwin's Lane. At the time, I suppose there were about a dozen houses in there, and they were generally for staff. So people from various different departments had accommodation along there. I think the engineer was quite grumpy about it because we didn't have any children and it was a 3-bed house, and he thought I should have a 1-bedroom flat, but the housing manager obviously was desperate to let this house. So when I got back home, I not only said that I'd been offered a job, but I'd been offered a house. That's where we started. So the engineers department, that was interesting because at the time, quite a tiny organisation, an urban district council. It had an engineers department, it had an architects department, it had a surveyors department, as well as people dealing with building control and planning and things like that. And we occupied some porter cabins out the back, which I think is probably now under where Watersmeet is, or maybe the car park at the back. There were probably 6 engineers at the time, as well as the chief engineer and then the boss.
So what was the work that the staff of the Urban District Council actually did?
Well, there were two main... One of the reasons why I was employed, I think, was we had 2 major projects on at the time. One was the construction of the original 2-storey car park in Northway. And at the time, the Scots Hill was partway through the construction of the dual carriageway. And there were still various works on the old river crossing on the old road that still needed to be completed. So they needed more engineering staff that had had experience of construction as opposed to sitting in an office and talking about it.
But the work was done by a contractor.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah. But they were two major projects. There were lots of other, in addition to professional staff, the council had what's called the works department, which did lots of minor works, road repairs and things like that. So if there was a sewer problem, then there was a team of workmen that could go out and attend to it straight away.
A bit of a difference from now.
Yes, yes. Well, of course, now nobody knows who repairs what, and possibly that's one of the reasons why things take so long.
We might come back to that.
Yeah.
Now, what was it like to be working in such an environment as a young engineer, not yet chartered and going towards it?
Well, I think I brought a different perspective because having worked on site, you get used to the rough and tumble of dealing with contractors, subcontractors, even directly employed staff that were building the things. So I can remember one conversation I had over the phone where I was trying to take the contractor to task about poor workmanship, and it brought the office to a deathly silence because I was brought into the chief engineer's office and told we don't speak to people like that. So my reply was, if you want something done, you do.
And was your remonstration effective?
Mm. Yeah, because we knew what we were doing and we knew what we wanted. So, yes.
You point out a difference between yourself and your own approach from the others in the office. How did that office of engineers actually work?
Well, because lots of the work was done effectively in-house, not only the design of it, but the construction of minor works was done by the works department. So we would be preparing small designs, bills of quantity, estimates, all of that sort of moved through the system, and then these projects were put forward to the council to see whether or not they would go in the budget for the following year. And then, of course, once the councillors had decided what projects they wanted to be carried out, just because of the way councils operated, it was a mad scramble to get the work done within the year. Otherwise you lost the money, as it were.
Now, there were you in the engineering side, and you had, as you say, an architect and other and surveyors, other skills, professional skills. How did the engineers get on with the architects?
Oh, quite well. I mean, it was surprisingly so, because they would design a project, and then when it came to the engineering works, we would have to design the beams and various other things that were in their projects. And then when they submitted their drawings and things to another council department for building regulation approval, they needed engineers' calculations and things like that, which we had provided them with.
Was that what gave you the design experience that you needed?
That was part of it. At the time, we did at the council, maintained and repaired all the sewers in the district. So if there were problems with those that needed a design solution, then that would come to the engineers to sort out. I mean, there were some major flooding in the council area as a result of heavy rain, which obviously the council is still experiencing. So we would be tasked to try and find solutions to things like that.
Now, it must have been about that time that the Local Government Act began to emerge. When did you start to realise that there was going to be this major change?
Well, I think I joined in 1972, and I'm pretty certain I would have been aware that local government reorganisation was going to happen in 74. So I went in with my eyes wide open, as it were. So to form Three Rivers, it was an amalgamation of Rickmansworth Urban District Council, Watford Rural, I think that was it.
Chorley Wood.
Oh, and Chorley Wood, yes. So, you know, at a strategic level, people were trying to work out where departments were physically going to go and whether there were competing individuals for the new post in the organisation. I think we were quite lucky in that I'm pretty certain that Watford Rural and Chorley Wood didn't have engineers or architects, so we just moved en bloc over to the new organisation. So that we started off in, I say, porter cabins or old sheds. My desk had a window next to it with a little step ladder underneath the window, because that was the fire escape. So if there was a fire in the office, we would have to climb up this little flight of stairs to get out my window. It's onto the ground. I was on the ground floor. It wasn't up in the air. So when we all merged, the engineers department went to Langley Road in Watford, which caused us all a bit of a problem because it obviously made our journeys that much longer.
But Langley Road isn't in Three Rivers.
No, it wasn't in Watford Rural either, I don't think.
So your particular part of the council was reasonably immune from being personally affected,
yes,
by
yes.
the change. Other bits of the council would have been a lot affected.
Yes, I mean, you know, working in the engineers department at a fairly junior level, none of the other departments, I don't suppose we would have been aware of what was happening and who was fighting for a job and things like that. I mean, where everybody went was quite an onerous problem. There was various buildings in Rickmansworth that the council used. That was obviously before Three Rivers House. So there was Basing House itself, where the museum is. Over the road was what's called the Bobie Building, which is now knocked down. I think that's where Bugler's new office has been built. There were obviously offices in Chorley Wood. I'm not sure where the Watford Rural offices were, although one of the engineers in the new organisation had come from Watford Rural, so they obviously had one or two people, but not on the size that Rickmansworth had.
Do you remember what sort of morale problems, concerns there were around in the council at that time?
I mean, at our level, I don't think anybody really had a particular problem. There was the prospect of it being a much larger area, more scope for more work. So I don't think anybody had a particular worry. I think the way that all of the amalgamations that were going on nationwide, there was a fair degree of protection offered to existing staff. And just, I don't know how I got involved, but I ended up as the union rep for Rickmansworth Urban District Council for NALGO, National Association of Local Government Officers, and I was the branch secretary for a while, and so was involved in the reorganisation in so far as if people tried, or different departments tried, to advertise jobs outside of the three organisations, then it was my job to go and talk to the chief executive and remind him that his chief officers should be following the nationally agreed rules, which caused a fair amount of angst amongst some of his chief officers.
Was that happening before the changeover?
Yes, that was in the period, in the sort of 2 years beforehand, these rules had been agreed between, you know, nationally by the national union and whether the local government committees and things or the council.
The new council must have taken on some new responsibilities apart from being a bigger area. Do you remember how that worked?
I don't know that anybody was aware that we took on new responsibilities. I mean, the whole idea of it was to try and, well, to be more efficient in terms of, you know, you don't need three planning departments, you can do with one, and perhaps strip out some layers of senior management, which is what happened. As I say, we were quite lucky in that there weren't many other engineers, or certainly the architect. I don't think either of the councils had an architect's department, so everybody around us was reasonably happy and content that the work was going to be there, their jobs were protected, and there may be more opportunities rather than less.
You said earlier, though, that road maintenance was a part of the responsibility of the Urban District Council.
Yes.
Didn't that migrate to the County Council in some way?
It did, but much later. Much later. I mean, I left in 76, so the organisations had really bedded in quite quickly, I think, as far as, you know, professional teams were concerned. And it was only much later that the County Council, if you like, exerted, because I think highway maintenance, I think, was a county responsibility, but they had passed that responsibility over to the district councils, and then I think later on, and I'm not quite sure how much later on, the county decided that we would do the whole lot themselves. And I think at that stage, they did away with in-house teams, and it all went to on a massive subcontract to highways contractor.
The adoption of private roads in the early days of the council.
The council had decided, because there were numerous roads that were private, Green Lane, Old Barn Lane, along the Green, the roads down there were privately maintained, not in a good state, and became increasingly difficult to get the local residents to maintain them to a reasonable standard. So the council had made a decision to create a programme of works where these roads would become maintained at public expense. So the engineers department would have to design the new road and the sewers that went under it, or make sure that they were up to standard. And then each householder had to pay to have the roads publicly maintained. And that was done on a straight linear footage. So if you had a small terraced house that was only 20 feet or 6 meters wide, that was one thing. If you owned the end house that was a corner plot that had a large frontage, both front and side, then you had to pay a hell of a lot more.
A one-off payment. And then your rates kept it...
Yes.
Kept it going.
Yes, yeah. So that was every year, one or two roads were being...
Were they through roads?
Well, the only ones I can remember locally were off the Green, and they were all cul-de-sacs. So,
even so, it was another significant investment by the council.
In time, yes, and effort, yeah.
It probably wasn't actually paid for fully by the poor old residents.
No, no. But I think you could only charge for the construction costs.
When you're getting ready for that sort of really quite significant change, nowadays you'd have all sorts of team meetings and briefings and God knows what else. Did that happen in 1974?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't remember going to any or many meetings about it. I think it was just when decisions had been taken. I mean, we knew the three organisations were going to merge together. Our concerns were, for initially, I suppose, for our jobs, and as far as we could see, there would be more work to do rather than less. And our only concern was, well, where will our office be, and will our working conditions be any better or worse than the ones that we were currently enjoying? I mean, the advantage of working in Rickmansworth itself was you've got access to the town centre during your lunch break or, you know, after work. When we went to Langley Road, it was too far out of the town to make use of any other facilities.
Now, you stayed on for a couple of years after the change. Were you still living in Dugdale's as you finished?
No. No, we'd moved to our present house, which we've been in for 50-something years. So we moved into this house in August 74. And I think our original mortgage might have been through the council, or if not the original one, then certainly when we did one of our extensions, we got a loan from the council, which was an offer to staff.
Now, broadening out then past your time in the council, you continue to live here and you've been a resident here for, as you say, more than 50 years. How have you seen the area change and develop, and this road itself change and develop in that time?
Well, I suppose the first thing to say is that obviously the number of cars in the district has multiplied enormously, and that's been a problem within Croxley Green, Three Rivers, and most of the houses were built in the 30s. Then car ownership was almost negligible. We've gone from that to a situation where most houses or most people in houses have at least two cars, maybe even more, and that's put a strain on the roads and parking generally. So that's a problem. It's a continually problem, especially near the stations, so that not only round Croxley Station, but I know around Rickmansworth Station, they have enormous problems of people parking outside individual houses during the day and then coming back and getting their cars in the evening, which puts a strain on everything. The other thing that has fluctuated and continues to fluctuate is the number of children in the area. So it seems to go in waves and cycles. So I think when we first arrived, then the schools, well, there was a new school, the Rickmansworth Junior Parks, an infant school had just been built to cope with increased numbers of children in the area. And over time, some of the local schools in Croxley went from one form to two form to three form entry to cope with the numbers. And then equally, at a later date, the secondary schools, both Durrance and William Penn, were closed because the number of secondary school pupils was falling. So what happens is the land was sold off and houses were built on it. And lo and behold, there were not enough secondary school places, which meant that the Reach School and Croxley Danes had to be built in the last 5 to 10 years to cope with the increasing number of secondary school pupils. And then we're now in a position, 2026, where pupil numbers at junior, infants and junior, is decreasing. So schools that were three-form entry are now down to two, and that will work its way through in the next 5 years to secondary schools, and there'll be pressure on the secondary schools with reduced numbers. And I know, because I'm a school governor, if your school isn't full, the finances don't work.
Now, that is a picture which in theory would be found across the country, probably more pronounced in areas like this. Are people tending to turn towards or look towards London in their daily life, or are we more localised than that?
I think Croxley Green is, as John Betjeman described, it's metro land, it's commuter belt, and where a lot of employment for men and women in the area is in London. So the trains are pretty full in the morning.
How have you found the development of local services other than the schools?
Well, I think Rickmansworth, for instance, that the High Street is a minor example of how out-of-town shops, i.e. Tesco's, has drained the resources from the High Street. High Streets are suffering at the moment because of the lack of footfall.
Have you seen that the local authority, Three Rivers District Council in this case, have been able to intervene in that in any meaningful way?
Well, not really. In fact, some of their actions have exacerbated the problem, in that they're charging for parking, restricting the time that you can park for free down to 1 hour. I suspect, the local traders that I've talked to said that had a dramatic effect on their business.
An unintended consequence.
Yes.
Now, coming back to yourself and your own career while you've been here, you say correctly that a lot of people around here commute. As a civil engineer, were you able to work reasonably locally, or did you travel the country or into London?
Both, really. When I left the council, I worked for a local builder, McInerney, on the Green. So I could walk to work. That was rather attractive. And then when I left them, I started working for John Lang, and their office at the time was in Watford, in Exchange Road, I think. But then they moved to Milton Keynes soon after I joined. And then at various stages in my career, I've worked in central London, in the West End, and travelled in on the train.
Thinking of the local aspect, what was the McInerney firm doing?
It started off as a general contractor, building houses and tower blocks in the Greater London Council area. And then they had decided to expand from becoming a contractor to doing some house building development, where they would buy the land and then develop it. And they needed an architect's department, and they needed an engineer or two.
Not just builders.
No.
Yes, that's an interesting reflection on a local business.
Yes.
Which is no longer here.
Well, I can't remember when, but it did go out of business, but it then reinvented itself almost immediately as Bugler and Co., because the original managing director was Tom Bugler.
So there's a local business which has not, in fact, vanished.
No.
It's just different.
Yes, it has evolved like a phoenix.
Have you, all right, in your professional life, but also just as a local resident, have you seen that happen very much?
I'm not aware of many other instances like that. I think they happen, and unless you're dealing with a particular company that goes out of business or reinvents itself, you don't notice. I think that the biggest change in terms of businesses locally was when John Lewis moved away from the Harlequin, and that caused, I think, a lot of people an upset.
Now, you were already living here when the Dickinson's Mill closed.
Yes.
And you've been here for some years.
Yes.
And also the Sun Printers. How did you find the local effects of that sort of really quite significant event?
Well, from an engineering point of view, I remember in my days at the council having to go and inspect the spoil heaps on the Dickinson's land to make sure that they were safe and they wouldn't suddenly collapse.
What spoil was in the spoil heaps?
All the old paper pulp.
Just slung out and piled
up?
Yes,
piled up, yeah. And so obviously if it got too high or dried out or got too wet, you might get a landslip that might cause a problem. Well, fortunately it didn't. So I think the fact that the local area is so close to London and London is so accessible that many of these changes obviously affected the people that worked in the immediate industry. But the print industry, for instance, it may have moved out of Watford, but it was still somewhere else and somebody somewhere reasonably local, so that if people's jobs moved, then it became a bit more of a car journey to get to work rather than the journey that they currently employ.
But already by then it was becoming a car journey that people were doing.
Yes, yeah. And of course, I suppose the one big change in terms of transport was the construction of the M25, because when we first moved here, any traffic that came down the M1 that wanted to go south or west of London came through Rickmansworth and Croxley Green on the A412. And Scotts Hill got quite a name for itself, and it's the reason the dual carriageway was being built, was that, you just mentioned the print industry. There were occasions when lorries laden with rolls of newspaper print tried to negotiate going up the old Scotts Hill, which is now the down route, and the rolls of paper fell off the back, which caused a fair amount of consternation if you were driving quite close behind them. So the whole construction of the M25, it was called the North Orbital to start off with, and bypassed from Maple Cross round to would be junction 19 or 20 nowadays. So that began to relieve the pressure on the local roads.
Yeah, that is quite a significant change, actually.
Yes.
Did it bring any other changes to the area other than making it easier not to be here?
Well, I think the and of course going way back, before the Rickmansworth bypasses were built, the traffic used to go through the High Street. So obviously local businesses enjoyed the passing traffic and trade that brought. So the moment you build a bypass around a town, traffic no longer stops, or the town becomes invisible to the passing traffic. That causes a loss of trade, no doubt.
But often portrayed as a mixed blessing.
Yes. I mean, I think we obviously have Northway that has been built. While I was in the engineers department, a Southway was being prepared to mirror Northway. I suspect, fortunately, that was never built.
I hadn't heard of Southway.
Yes.
Where was it suggested it might be built?
If you take Berry Lane and going round to where the Marks and Spencer's is, I would have to go and look at the old maps. But there were certainly plans being drawn up and options being drawn up to mirror Northway and have a Southway.
Because Northway itself resulted from the removal of a lot of the town centre.
Yes.
Southway will have done very interesting damage.
Yes, it would have done a lot more damage than Northway did. Because I think Northway was built largely on gardens, long gardens of the buildings and houses along the High Street. Obviously it did demolish some very famous buildings in the process.
But a lot of them had meadows and fields behind anyway.
Yes.
Now, other bits of the district will be of interest, like Chorley Wood. Have you had much involvement in your time, well, in the council, but as a resident, with the development of places like Chorley Wood, Sarratt, Abbots Langley?
No, is the simple answer. I think other than the normal complaints and anxieties that are thrown up when more and more houses are due to be developed, no. So, I mean, I think the pressure on Croxley to produce yet more houses is a battle that is still being fought and will continue to be.
So how do you see, as a resident, long-standing resident, how do you see the consequences of this reorganisation and we all become South West Hertfordshire?
Well, I think we will all become more remote from where decisions are going to be taken. I mean, I don't know if anybody has decided where the office will be for South West Herts.
Not that I've heard.
But one's ability to go and talk to a member of staff at an office becomes increasingly remote and more difficult as time goes on. And that's not good for democracy, really.
One could suggest, of course, that gap will then be filled by the parish slant town councils. How would you feel about that?
One of the great changes, I suppose, in democratic control over the last 50 years has been the hoovering up of responsibility for taking decisions, and it's all gone into Westminster. And so decisions that were taken at a urban district council level are now taken at a county level or even a regional level. And that makes it more difficult for individuals to have a meaningful input into the decision-making process. And that's going to get worse with the reorganisation.
Are you being drawn into this discussion as a school governor?
Not so far. There are other things happening within the school environment as to whether or not a school will stay a county school or whether it would become part of an academy chain. There's that argument going on amongst all the local schools, and obviously it's too early to say how the county will split the responsibilities for education. So I think as long as individual schools and governors and parents are able or feel that they are able to make a contribution and know who's making the decisions, then that will be okay. If you don't know who's making the decision, either because it's taken at a much higher level or the local representative is not accessible, then that will cause a problem.
Just to finish, what advice would you, as a citizen, as a resident, what advice would you give to those preparing the new reorganised structure?
Well, try and make sure that the reach that you have goes from the individual household to the decision makers, and to set up lines of communication. I know just recently one of the bugbears I had with the local council, where they had problems with the playing field at Rickmansworth and in the Aquadrome, wasn't that there was a problem, it's just that they didn't communicate with the residents about what had happened, what they were doing about it, and when the thing was likely to be opened. So I think there's a great gulf in communication between decision makers and individual householders. Unless that is managed properly and well, then I think people will be beginning to grumble.
I think that's a pretty good place to stop. Michael, many thanks indeed.
Okay.